This is case number 85734-COA, Kim Judd versus State of Nevada. Time set for the oral argument. And counsel, if you could state your appearance for the record.
Yes, Your Honor, thank you. My name is Franklin Katchke from Lincoln County Public Defender.
Okay. You going to help me with the pronunciation again?
Katchke.
Katchke, all right, phonetically. All right, and then we also have the state through the Lincoln County District Attorney's Office.
Yes, Your Honor, Dylan Frainer, Lincoln County District Attorney, and with me is Hannah Blake, second-year law student, who has interned in our office, helped prepare briefs, and was prepared to hopefully argue before the court, but grades didn't come in on time to get a provisional license.
Oh, almost.
We'll throw the blame on.
All right. Do you attend Boyd? Okay, did you invite any of your friends and family here, hoping to see your first court appearance?
I did see my little family, yeah.
All right, well, I don't know if we can do anything about that.
I wish we could.
All right, well, welcome for being here, and thank you so much for coming in. This is the start of a long and illustrious career, I'm sure, even if it's just sitting at council table. All right, would you like to reserve any time, Mr. Katchke, for a rebuttal?
Yes, 2 minutes, Your Honor.
All right, so you were able to see the last argument and heard all the introductory comments we made, so we're not going to repeat any of that.
I actually walked in late. I apologize. I drove 3 hours this morning, and we had some weather and some traffic, so I apologize about that.
You must not have been to Las Vegas for a while.
Not for a while.
All right. Well, essentially what I said was that counsel is welcome to remain after the argument. There might be questions from the audience, particularly students, and we won't talk about the facts of any case, but just generally your law practice, how you got here, and what's it like to engage in this sort of experience. So hopefully this is something that you're going to enjoy and it's worth the drive. And we're certainly very interested in this case. I can't remember ever setting a case from Lincoln County for argument. Now, I have been to Lincoln County. I won't go that far. I've been to Lincoln County. Well, don't say that. No, it's a beautiful area. When I first got on the bench, I went to the Caliente Youth Center to visit that, because at the time I was in district court and we had juvenile court jurisdiction and a juvenile facility in our county, so I was looking around. But at any rate, I digress. We will move on to this particular case, and how much time did you say you wanted to reserve?
2 minutes, please.
2 minutes, all right, you may proceed.
Thank you, Chief Judge Gibbons, Judge Bola, and Judge Westbrook, and may it please the court. As I said, my name is Franklin Katchke, I'm the Lincoln County Public Defender. I represent the appellant, Kim Judd, in this manner. I was also his trial counsel in the 7th Judicial District Court. On August 17, 2022, Mr. Kim Judd was convicted of two counts, the first count being injuring or tampering with a motor vehicle, a Category C felony in the state of Nevada, and count two of coercion, a Category B in the state of Nevada. The statute of coercion is interesting. It's split up into two different parts. The first part, under subsection 1, I call the violation part, and under subsection 2, I call the penalty part of the statute. An individual who commits one of three acts in the state of Nevada can be convicted for the crime of coercion. Mr. Judd was charged under the first two, either A or B, and A states that if an individual uses violence or inflict injury upon the other person or any of the person's family or upon the other person's property or threaten such violence or injury, or B, deprive the person of any tool, implement, or clothing, or hinder the person in the use thereof. Your Honor, there's no argument today that Mr. Judd injured the property or even threatened to injure the property. The testimony that was given the state's case in chief was very similar to the testimony that was offered by the defense at trial. However, where the contention and where the argument arose is regarding the penalty phase of coercion and how the court should proceed with either the felony or the misdemeanor. At the end of the state's case in chief, Mr. Judd, at the end of the state's case in chief, moved for a dismissal under count two because the state had failed to prove that there was either physical force used or the immediate threat of physical force, and that the court should move forward with a misdemeanor case at that point and remand the matter back to justice court. During that argument, I informed the court that under NRS 193.303, the Nevada legislature has defined physical force. And it's defined in that statute as the means of application or physical techniques, chemical agents, or weapons to another person. Now, the reason that the trial court took issue with this definition, because NRS 293.3015 to NRS 193.309, that sequence of statutes, the heading of that sequence of statutes is use of force by peace officers. But during my reading of those statutes, there's nothing within that sequence that states the definitions found within that sequence should exclusively be used for the crimes found in NRS 193.3015 to NRS 193.309. I'm sorry, yeah, 309. So I requested the district court at that time, I moved for a dismissal and requested again the court remand this matter to justice court to be dealt there, or in the alternative, to instruct the jury as to the definition of what physical force is. At that time, I believe it was the end of the first day of trial, the district court took it under advisement, and during the next morning, prior to the presentation of the defense's case in chief, issued a ruling essentially stating that the court is unwilling to apply the definition as found in NRS 193.303 to Mr. Judd's case at the time, because the court believed that the definition found in NRS 193 should only apply to cases where there's a use of force by a peace officer.
So why should we extend it?
I'm sorry?
Why should we extend that definition, which relates to peace officers, to a different context here being coercion?
Absolutely. First of all, it's the only definition found in Nevada revised statutes regarding physical force. Secondly, again, there's nothing in that sequence of statutes between 3.015 and 309 stating that the definitions found there are exclusive to the use of force by peace officers. Now, for instance, if that definition under NRS 193.303 said physical force means the application of physical techniques, chemical agents, or weapons to another person by a peace officer were in that definition, absolutely, the definition should be limited to, I guess, crimes that are committed by peace officers. But again, the statute and the definition found there is very broad, and there's no words in that definition, limiting that to use of force by peace officers.
And Mr. Katchke, you offered a definition of physical force. You offered a jury instruction with a definition.
Yes, Your Honor, at the end of the first day of jury trial, the state and I received the packets from the district court regarding the jury instructions. I was under the assumption that the definition of physical force would be provided in that. When I saw that there was a definition lacking of physical force in that packet, I submitted NRS 193.303 to be submitted as part of a jury instruction to the packet. That request was denied by the district court.
Is there any evidence in the record that is before us that would demonstrate that the victim in this case, Mr. Weber, had any physical force used against him or an immediate threat of physical force by the defendant?
No, Your Honor. In fact, in my opening brief, I forget what page it is at this time, I cite to the exact transcript of that time of the questions that I asked. Scott Weber was the name of the victim of the crime. And I asked him about the phone call. There was a phone call that occurred with Kim Judd, who's the appellant in this case, and there were a couple of text messages exchanged, and then there was a second phone call. It was during the second phone call that Mr. Judd had threatened to do damage to Mr. Weber's property. He used the word repossess work to do damage to his property if Mr. Weber attempted to come to his property to get the vehicle. I asked Mr. Weber at that time if he was within eyesight of Mr. Judd, and he said, no, I couldn't see him. And then I asked Mr. Weber the exact question whether he had felt threatened by Mr. Judd at that time, and his answer to that question was, no, I did not feel threatened by him to bodily injury at that time.
Do you know where both gentlemen were when the call was made?
Yes, I believe Mr. Judd was at his residence just south of Panaca, Nevada, about a mile south of Panaca, and it's my understanding that Mr. Weber was just outside of a town called Caliente, which is about 12 to 13 miles away when that call was made.
Thank you.
Thank you. If If this court is unwilling to extend the definition found in NRS 193.303 to the case at hand, the question remains, what do the words physical force mean? Now, I think looking at the statute itself is pretty instructive, because what the state has done throughout these arguments and what the state argued to the district court is that physical force or immediate threat of physical force can be used against an inanimate object or personal property. But it's important to note that in Section 1A of the coercion statute, it uses very specific words. It says, uses violence or inflict injury upon the other person's property. So it uses the words, use violence or inflict injury. But when the court jumps down to subsection 2A, it uses the very specific term, physical force or immediate threat of physical force. So I think it's important to note here that the legislature, when passing this act, used two very different terms when talking about injury to property and when talking about physical force that should be applied only to bodily injury or to harm to a person.
What do we do with the fact that we've got the supplemental authority citing Garina, and there's language in Garina that states felony coercion consists of the use or immediate threat of violence or injury against a person or property?
Right, and I think that distinction needs to be made there again between the violation section of the statute and the punishment section. I read the Garina case, and the Garina was pretty clear, and again, it quotes, I believe it's Santana as well in that case. And again, those cases, when we talk about these cases that the state has cited in their brief, those justices are discussing the violation portion of that statute.
Are you sure? Because it clarifies. I mean, this says felony coercion. That indicates, I mean, there's a distinction between misdemeanor and felony. So it seems like, I mean,
right.
Is this dicta, or is this, do you think this is a holding in Garina?
I read the case, and I know that Garina specifically talks, the case is definitely about coercion of immediate threat of physical force against a person. And I can't remember, I'm sorry, in that case, if it was either against a public officer or a sexual assault case. But I know that that case specifically was regarding a person. In fact, if you do any research that's done on the words physical force, there are only a matter of two or three subject cases that come up when researching physical force. One is sexual assault. One is piece of an officer, and if you do a national search of the words physical force, you also get detention cases regarding Fourth Amendment search and seizures. And I understand, my answer to you, Judge Westbrook, and I saw that, was I think it was a mistake in language there, and I think it's dicta at that point. There just hasn't been any discussion in the state of Nevada, nor many other states, what the appeals court or the Nevada Supreme Court. And I don't think they've been asked to define what physical force is. And so since those justices, they were not focused on the question of whether it's not a Category B felony, because it was apparent it was a Category B felony in the Guarina case, or whether it was a misdemeanor.
Is it correct then that the term physical force, as it is used in the second part of that section regarding coercion, really is the difference between whether it should be charged as a felony versus charged as a misdemeanor?
Absolutely.
And if we didn't have that terminology or that distinction, then would everything be charged as a misdemeanor, or would everything be charged as a felony?
Exactly. And this is the argument I made in my opening brief, is that if we adopt the state's view of what the word physical force means, it essentially negates the punishment part of the statute. It means that if the state meets any burden under the violation, then the thinking that I've done about it, any violation of the coercion statute is necessarily going to be charged as a Category B felony. And as I was looking through the Category B felony statutes, now most of the Category B felony statutes are reserved for person crimes, sexual assaults, batteries on an officer causing substantial bodily harm, and a lot of person crimes. There are a number of property crimes that are listed as Category B felonies, but oftentimes those are reserved for property crimes that are in excess of $25,000. And so what the state's adoption of physical force essentially means is that if we threaten, if we even attempt to hurt someone's property and do zero damage to it, $0 in damage, that person is getting punished at the same level and is looking at 1 to 6 years in prison, as my client is now, for someone who's done $25,000 worth of damage, someone who's sexually assaulted someone else, someone who's battered and caused substantial bodily harm. So the question is also whether or not the state's interpretation of physical force is proportional and it's equitable to what the laws and what justice demands in the state of Nevada.
Do we know, has the Supreme Court or Court of Appeals ever affirmed a defendant's felony coercion conviction that's based solely on the threat to property?
The research I have done has shown zero cases discussing coercion in terms of property crimes. The research that I have done in researching physical force or the immediate threat of physical force, again, is associated with two main crimes, kidnapping, sexual assault, and use of force by peace officers in the state of Nevada. And additionally, there are other states, again, these were quoted, I believe these definitions were also given to district court, I can't remember, but they were obviously quoted in my opening brief, both in Kentucky and the state of Arizona. They define physical force as force used upon or directed toward the body of another person, and the same is true with Arizona. And I think it's also important to know that is that my 2 minutes reserved, or is that 2 minutes left?
2 minutes left.
You got a yellow light there.
Okay, so I apologize. Thank you.
You can use that 2 minutes how you want, but you might want to retain it.
Yes, that's the total of, it started with 15 minutes. I'm sorry, I will sit down and resume.
15 minutes have gone by.
Thank you, Your Honor. Appreciate it.
All right, we'll put you back to 2 minutes then up for a rebuttal. All right, we'll turn to the state's side of this case now for the respondent, Mr. Frainer.
Got a couple of names that you've got to have issues with, Frainer and Kachke. Good luck.
Yours is a little easier.
Only if you hear it before you have to say it.
Okay. Is this true about Caliente? That's where the victim allegedly was during that phone call?
Yes, Your Honor. With regards to the facts of the case, I think Mr. Kachke has presented them fairly accurately. Mr. Judd and Mr. Reber are friends. They had worked together for many years. Mr. Reber had given Mr. Judd his vehicle, this 1957 Chevy, to work on. And after about a year, Mr. Reber called Mr. Judd and said, I'm going to come get it. I need it back. And when he did that is when Mr. Judd said, you're not getting it back unless you pay me more money. And if you don't pay me more money now, I'm either going to kill you or I'm going to burn down your truck and repossess my work. As indicated, Mr. Reber was not in a close proximity, 10 to 15 miles away. And so I think even at trial, we withdrew that as an instruction, and we focused on the property issue because he did have the property in his possession. And there's no dispute that he took a sledgehammer and beat it violently in accordance with the statute. So the question that the court has asked us to focus on today is whether that physical force that Mr. Judd applied to Mr. Reber's truck constitutes coercion when he tried to use that truck against him to get more money and to damage that truck and to injure the truck.
Is the hypothetical that we heard from Mr. Kachke at the end a good one? He says if a person threatened to do damage to property, never actually damaged any property, you could still have a felony charge under the state's interpretation of the statute.
That's correct. I think when we look at the statute, and when we're looking at this case, it is a statutory interpretation for you to review de novo. Mr. Kachke has kind of jumped right into a construction phase of looking at what the legislative history and other things. But when we look at the actual verbiage of the statute itself, it pretty much goes forward and says this applies to everything. I know it's broken down into subsections 1 and 2. Subsection 1 was passed before the 1967 amendment, and then the physical force was added in 1967 to break up the difference between felony and misdemeanor, and they added that physical force provision. But it's interesting, his argument is that if you just, any violence or any infliction of injury or any threat of injury to property would be felony under our regards, and that's not entirely true. There are other injuries out there that could happen with regards to property that are not felonious. If someone sends malware to my phone or to my computer, or sends a virus, that is injuring my property, but it doesn't entail physical force where they take a sledgehammer out and break my computer. There's a difference and a distinction there, and it's not as de minimis as Mr. Kachke makes it seem, that it's going to include everything that's out there. There's still some discretion with the district attorneys, with those that are prosecuting cases through the courts, to make sure that this is done properly.
Mr. Frainer, let me ask a question. Have you read the legislative history?
Pardon?
Have you read the legislative history associated with this statute?
We did go back and look at the 1967 editions. We didn't find any specific language because it was a fairly large bill with regards to what was added. A lot of crimes, an omnibus crime bill is what I called it, just for the fact that it added so many provisions. There wasn't specific language about the physical force provision that we could find.
Would you agree that the use of physical force in many of the statutes that do reference it is physical force against a person, not against property?
In the ones that we found from the 1960 legislation, there were many that were general and many that were specific. And those that were specific were to a person, but there was only about four or five of those. Most of them that we found were general, and with those provisions that they added to the statute, those statutes also had injuries to property included with them, like the oppression statute. There are several
others.
Well,
with regard to coercion, how would a decision be made to charge coercion felony versus coercion misdemeanor if there isn't some sort of line that we can look to? And wouldn't that line be physical force against a person or threat of physical force? So there's an immediate threat to someone's person. Why wouldn't that be a good dividing line between felony coercion and misdemeanor coercion?
We believe it is a good line. It just doesn't need to be limited just to the person. It is a good line in this case specifically. The property was in Mr. Judd's possession. He was able to use it against the victim by threatening to damage it.
So the value of the property itself wouldn't matter?
No, not at this point in time.
So
certainly, I think it comes back to discretion. If it's a pencil, if you take my pencil and threaten to break it if I don't pay you more money, obviously there has to be some discretion in how you apply that and common sense.
But then aren't you really focusing on the value damage of the property instead of the actual concern that's at issue, which is the use of physical force or the threat of physical force?
With regards to the case law that we have, I think that was a question previously, is there any case law that has divided it specifically or seen specifically with property? And at this point in time, we don't. But the Nevada Supreme Court has reviewed several cases where property and persons were connected.
Right, but that's not the case here, is it?
It is not the case.
I just got back from Pioche, so I know all these places that everyone's been talking about, and Caliente is a ways away from where Mr. Judd was, I believe.
It is. And Mr. Katschke has made a point that there aren't any property statutes out there with regards to Category B felonies, and that's not true. You have the extortion statute. And in hindsight, that is probably the statute that we should have cited this under. Going back, the extortion statute says if you threaten somebody with regards to their property, it is automatically a Category B felony to try to get them to pay more money. And so there's not a misdemeanor or felony division there, but under that statute, it's very specific. It's a Cat B felony if you try to get more money out of people by threatening their person or their property.
But extortion wasn't charged here.
It was not.
Thank you.
But again, when we look at the plain meaning of the statute in this case, and that's where I think we have to start. It does state here under subsection 2, a person who violates the provisions of subsection 1. It doesn't limit it in any way, shape, or form. And with regards to the term physical force, that's where it comes up with the distinction. But it doesn't, as in the other statutes like we talked about, in other ones like the prostitution statute, it says physical force against a person. If they wanted to limit it to a person in 1967, they did that in several other statutes. They did not do it into the coercion statute.
Isn't there at least an ambiguity? I mean, it can be read two different ways. It could be read to be force against a person, or it could just be read as, you know, broadly.
In the statute itself, I don't think there is that, because as you read it, it just says against the provisions of subsection 1, physical force. It doesn't break it down. It doesn't qualify it by saying it only against a person.
But it's not defined, correct? You'd agree that it's not defined within this statute?
Correct. Physical force is used many places in the statutes, and it's not defined. The only definition that came into place was in 2021 with the law enforcement provisions in 193.303 that Mr. Katschke had provided to the court asking for that jury instruction. But the court, again, looking at the plain language of the statute, says it doesn't need to have that definition, and that definition does not apply here, because it is very specific to that law enforcement. And so physical force, and that's why we've, in our brief, have provided it. It's a term that has been used many times throughout the statutes, has very few definitions. In fact, it's even used in some definitions. I believe if you look at the forcible entry of home invasion, the definition of forcible entry actually uses the term if they break into a house using physical force. And so it is a term of common knowledge that we can use if someone is using force against another. Going beyond just the plain language of the statute, we also have the Garina case. And I know you've asked whether that is dicta or whether that is a controlling in this case. Certainly in Garina, there was a provision, and I think it's very important, I think the court noted that, they didn't define physical force, but they defined felony coercion. Let me just turn to that language real fast. Felony coercion consists of the use or immediate threat of violence or injury against a person or property. And in that case, they did have an issue. The person was present, and the defendant had asked them to disconnect a phone. And it was that connection to property or a tool or something else that she had to disconnect. That is why I believe they put this language in here with regards to property.
But he had just robbed her, correct? They were, and he was blocking, he was physically blocking her door. They were in very close proximity, so she potentially could reasonably fear for her own physical safety under those circumstances.
That is correct. Okay. But I don't think that this is dicta in this case. The facts are definitely distinguishable, but the Supreme Court in this point in time is pretty much announcing the rule. This is what felony coercion consists of. They're stating this is the law. They've looked at the statute on its face. They've seen a plain reading. They haven't done any interpretation or construction on it. They've looked at it on its face and said this is what felony coercion consists of, which is what the judge did in our case. The statute was plain on its face. That was the rule. There are other cases that we did not cite in our brief. They're unpublished opinions that the Nevada Supreme Court has looked at. Three other telephone cases from 2016 to 2018. There's actually one that I would like to mention. That one is with regard to, it's ATWA.
I'm sorry, can you say that one more time, please?
ATWAL v. State, 385 Pacific 3rd, 603. And in that case, specifically, the defendant even argued the same argument that's being brought here today. He wanted a lesser-included instruction to be presented to the jury, saying that he could be convicted only of misdemeanor coercion because it should be limited that he had only touched an object or made a threat against an object and not the person. And the court rejected that argument at that point in time. And again, I understand there's some distinguishing facts because the person was holding a phone,
right,
and that phone was taken from them or slapped out of their hands. Or,
okay.
And so the person was still there. But that argument has been presented and been rejected out of hand by the Nevada Supreme Court in that case.
We are not dealing with a lesser-included charge argument here, though, are
no.
we?
But I think it's very similar because Mr. Katschke, at trial, had requested this jury instruction. At first, he had asked for a dismissal because he argued felony or physical force was not alleged. That was denied. He then asked for the jury instruction to limit this to a misdemeanor with regards to the physical force definition in 193.303. So I think it's very similar, although it was not a lesser included instruction.
So would you be able to charge someone with felony coercion? Let's think of a law school hypothetical. You've got a study group. One person has taken some copious notes, gives it to somebody else in the study group. And that person gets upset and says, hey, if you don't help me some more, I'm going to rip up your notes. I'm threatening to rip up your property. Is that felony coercion?
Potentially, yes. If those notes from my days in law school would have been very valuable. I had put a lot of effort into those. And if that was the only copy I had, absolutely. That would be something of great value to me.
All right, students, take note.
But I think that the felony coercion was not meant to be restricted, and it was intended to be applied outwardly. The three telephone cases, again, just an interesting note, the Ninth Circuit actually reviewed those three cases in trying to decide if felony coercion in the state of Nevada was a crime of violence under the federal statutes. And they actually made the determination after reviewing those three unpublished opinions that in Nevada, the Supreme Court was most likely to include felony coercion against property based upon those three decisions, and they would not make felony coercion a violent crime under the federal statutes for that purpose. That decision actually came out before the Garina decision. In fact, it came out actually the day after the Garina decision, so they didn't include Garina in that analysis. And so even the federal court has looked at this and said, most likely this is going to be, felony coercion is going to be include property crimes,
what
not just
saying?
Against the person. That case is Edling. United States v. Edling, 891 Fed 3rd, 1190.
In Edling, though, wasn't there some proximity between the victim and the defendant?
Honestly, in Edling, they,
or
didn't,
did
even,
they, address
they
it?
Didn't even get into the facts. It was just that he had a felony coercion on his history, and they were using that for enhancement purposes under the federal guidelines, and to see if it would be a violent crime. Overall, at this point in time, certainly you have the opportunity, you have the right to review this de novo to determine what physical force includes. But when we look at what was actually appealed, Mr. Judd's argument, it was that he offered a jury instruction and the judge did not follow it. Those are reviewed generally for an abuse of discretion. And at this point in time, Judge Fairman, when he reviewed this case, he looked at the statutory provision, he read it clean on his face like the court in Garina did, and he refused to give the instruction from 193.303 because it did not apply. And it would have been more confusing to the jury to have that instruction that very specifically deals with law enforcement, talking about types of techniques, chemicals. Those are all related to that legislation in 2021 that is very specific to law enforcement. So in this case, Judge Fairman did not make or err when he refused to give that instruction. There was no other instruction offered beyond the 193.303. And so when
but
he refused to give that.
Trial courts are supposed to help craft the instruction if the general concept is correct and then get the wording exactly right for it to go to the jury. The court can't just stand back and say, well, that doesn't apply because that part's for law enforcement if the general concept still applies.
But that's true, because, but at the same time, the court had asked us to provide jury instructions before trial. And the defense had not provided any until after the case in chief of the state, trying to throw that out there. This is something that could have said, this case or this statute is ambiguous. Let's have a review. Let's have a full hearing on it and go through that. We didn't do that. This was thrown out right after the case in chief of the state, after the motion to dismiss was denied. He said, well, we want this definition instead as a jury instruction. And we didn't have a full hearing with regards to that. And the judge had to make that decision, which he did correctly.
I just have one quick question, though. There was not an initial instruction on physical force, though, included in the packet. Is that right?
That's correct. The instruction that came from the court was based straight off of the statute itself, indicating that physical force or the threat of physical force was used, it would be a felony, and if it was not used, then it would be a misdemeanor. That was the instruction that he provided to us.
But neither the state nor the defense provided an instruction initially.
Initially for physical force, no.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Frainer. Go back to Mr. Katschke.
Thank you, Your Honors. Just to discuss the issue of the jury instruction, going into trial, every trial counsel knows and understands that they expect some level of jury instructions. And to me, on the day of when the jury instructions were provided, I was surprised that there was no definition of physical force. And that's why NRS 193.303 should have been submitted to the jury at that time, even if the state believes it was late in the day. And there would have been no confusion regarding the 303 statute, because the statute itself and the definition I provided made no mention of use by peace officers. It uses the word physical techniques, chemical agents, or weapons, but any individual can use physical techniques, chemical agents, or weapons against another individual, again, which was not the matter in this case. Also, regarding AB 71, which was passed in 1967, originally the respondent brought this up in their brief, and he discussed a specific statute. It's NRS 201-360, which is regarding the forcible prostitution of another person. Now, I think that this statute is very important for this court to determine what the word physical force means, because in 1967, when AB 71 was first passed, the word physical force against a woman was used to physically force a woman into prostitution. 12 years later, in 1979, the Nevada legislature took out the words "of a woman" and left the words "physical force" in there. My understanding and belief was that because the state legislature understood and knew that both men and women can be forced into prostitution. So to believe now that physical force, you can use physical force against an inanimate object, I guess, to force someone into prostitution and be the same level of felony with the same level of punishment of using physical force against another person, again, I think would go against the common understandings of justice, of what it means to be found guilty of a Category B felony in the state of Nevada. Thank you.
Did the court make a pretrial order about submitting jury instructions at a certain time?
Yes, Your Honor, it did.
And when was the package actually given to the counsel?
The package that the court prepared was given to counsel at the end of the first day of jury trial before we broke for the evening, Your Honor. And that's when I realized that there was no definition of physical force.
All righty. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Great job, both counsel. Very helpful. Much appreciated by the court. And everybody stuck to our order to focus on a certain topic. I thought we might go further, but we didn't. So a very, very key issue here. So this matter will stand submitted for a written decision at a later time. Of course, we'll try to do that as soon as we can. If counsel can remain for a few minutes, see if we have any questions from students or professors. Yes, and use the microphone wherever we can.
We want Mr. Chen and Mr. Owens to come up as well?
Oh, certainly.
You'll have to share the tables.
Yes.
There's only one more chair there.
Well, I'm sure we can find another chair.
Yeah.
That's the one of the questions of perfect.
Yeah.
Oh. Well. Okay. Who else is with you, Mr. Chen? Who else is with you?
Sure. So along with me are two of my current law clerks who joined for now a couple months, Elizabeth Iruli and Dallin Albright, and they've been great law clerks. And if anyone has questions about kind of the job, I think they're in the best position to tell what they do on a daily basis.
Thank you. All right, if you have a question for an individual or just in general, just state at the beginning.
Okay, I have a question for counsel and also for you judges. My name is Vanessa, I'm a 1L. And for the counsel, I just wanted to know, what does it feel like to constantly be interrupted by the judges? Does that throw you off? How does that feel? How do you bounce back into what you were initially discussing?
You know, this is one of the rare situations where it's really expected. Now, that doesn't mean people like it, but it is expected, and we just do it that way. We try to be polite about it, but I'll let counsel answer that.
Isn't that what they do in law school? That's what I remember my 1L was like. Anytime I tried to answer something, the professors just interrupted you all the time. It's no different when you get into the courtroom.
Yeah, I think you just kind of expect it, although this panel certainly had relevant questions. Sometimes stuff gets thrown from left field and you're a little bit perplexed and you try to bring it back to what you wanted to talk about, I think. But I think it is something that you just get trained to do, and it's not rude. Everyone expects it. There are just certain things that people want to know about, and the judges get to dictate how that goes.
I actually prefer if they ask more questions. We've had oral arguments before the Supreme Court where they didn't ask questions, or we didn't know what direction they want us.
We actually had an order saying, we want you to focus on this one. It was great. But we haven't had that. We've had six issues that we've been focusing on. Their questions are very helpful with focusing on what they want since they have the
answers. Yeah, so during preparation, I mean, there's a lot of reading that goes involved, but the amount that you actually put on paper is very limited. It's basically an outline of the important parts the important cases and what exactly you want to talk about. But at the end of the day, I think it would be more frustrating, at least for myself, to have a 15-minute speech than the back and forth that you obviously, we obviously had with the justices this morning.
I've actually done several oral arguments, all in the Nevada Supreme Court, where there were no questions. And so I learned to come prepared with a speech just in case. But more often than not, you get interrupted, and so you have notes that you go down, and you just have to adjust on the fly. And that's true of any courtroom work. As a trial lawyer, you get interrupted. You have things just happen on the fly, and you just have to think on your feet continually. And that's what we do here.
So, yeah. Mr. Owens, what if there's an unexpected question? So on your case, there was no limitation on what could be asked. On the second case, we did an order that directed counsel's attention to a certain topic. So how do you prepare for the vast range of topics or something that might happen that's in the record somewhere and you didn't do the trial? And it must be really tough to be prepared for every possible question. So how do you handle the unexpected question?
Well, I try to come prepared for everything, knowing that we're not in 15 minutes, we're not going to be able to get to everything. And so I try to identify what I think are the most important issues that may not jive with the feedback I'm getting from the judges. I may find that they think there's some other issue that's important. So then I kind of adjust my argument. Also, I listen to counsel. Maybe they think there's one of the other issues that's more important that I didn't catch on. So I try to come back around to that. But you prepare for everything, and then you have to be comfortable really just limiting it down and thinking on the fly and getting to what you can. Now, you get questions all the time. I was asked here, I mean, we don't want to get into specific cases, but I was asked about the holding of a case. And I frankly did not know the answer to that, and that's what I said here. I've seen far too often judges ask an attorney a question that the attorney didn't know, and they bluffed. And the judges pinned them down on it, and it became apparent that they didn't know what they were talking about. So I learned just to be honest. I don't know the answer, and so I give them the best answer I can, but it's okay to admit that you don't know everything.
Thank you all for that feedback. I really appreciate it. And then the question I had for the judges was, in the second case, it mentioned counsel had mentioned an unpublished case, and I was wondering, do you prefer that an unpublished case is mentioned in the brief or that it comes up in oral argument?
Well, it sort of depends on what kind of unpublished case, because right now we have a rule that limits citation to unpublished Court of Appeals decisions, which we're working on getting that modified so that you can cite to all unpublished Court of Appeals decisions and additionally unpublished Supreme Court decisions that predate 2016. But, I mean...
Right. I mean, counsel aren't supposed to make new arguments per se, but they can supplement their arguments and cite cases. And if there are unpublished cases that are appropriate to cite, they can cite that within the rules. So it's helpful. That's part of the reason for argument, is to find out, you know, what's most important. Is there anything new? We overlooked anything? When we want to make sure we've covered all of the angles.
We're not required, or I mean, they're not mandatory authority. It's just considered persuasive if it's citable, if it falls within an unpublished disposition that can be cited. We can consider it, but it's not mandatory authority.
Thank you so much.
If there's any way we can help that,
So the ADKT is actually going to be coming out very soon, which will, there will be like a month-long comment period, and then the Supreme Court will consider the comments that people are going to be making, you know, issues that they may have with the proposed rules of appellate procedure, and then they will have the opportunity to amend the rules, and hopefully, fingers crossed, they amend that rule, and then all of our brilliant unpublished orders will be citable.
There will be time for public comment, so that would be probably the time to weigh in if you're interested.
Yes.
Perfect, thank you. If counsel could, before we go with any further questions, introduce yourselves and what your position is and how you happened to got to where you are, and if there's anything in law school that pushed you in that direction, or did it come about later? We could start with Mr. Chen on the end.
So I graduated law school in 2007. I've been with the Clark County District Attorney's Office ever since I graduated from law school. So I'm actually from Ohio. I moved out here to be a law clerk in what Elizabeth and Dallin are now doing, and that's how I started my legal career. My goal when I went to law school was to be a trial attorney. The office gave me that, but when Mr. Owens decided that it was time for him to retire, the office simply had a need for an appellate attorney. And it was not what I envisioned for myself. It was not what I thought, but getting to do things now, I run the appellate division of the Clark County District Attorney's Office. It's been awesome to see and to kind of experience law from the appellate side of things. And there's a whole post-conviction world that exists out there, too. If you watch Netflix and Making of a Murderer, you've probably seen some of that post-conviction world. But it's been really rewarding to see things from this angle as well. Certainly doing trials was what I did for 15 years, or for probably 14 years. Now doing it on this end, it certainly helped me out a bunch. But that's basically where I'm from.
Okay, Mr. Frainer.
Thank you. I graduated in 2004 from the McGeorge School of Law in Sacramento. And I grew up in rural Nevada. Wasn't sure if I wanted to go back, but everything led me back there. I clerked for 7th Judicial District Court judges for a year. Did private practice for many years, public defense, before becoming the district attorney. One thing I will say is that if you want a variety in what you do, come out to the rurals. I'm one of two attorneys in my office, and we do everything from criminal to prosecution to representing our commissioners, to representing the county on all the civil issues. There is never a boring moment out in rural Nevada when it comes to legal work that needs to be done. But it certainly, you never feel like you're the master of anything. We're trying to figure it all out on the go. Mr. Katchke and I, you know, we're trial and appellate counsel in all of this. We have to do everything because we're the only ones in our offices. So, but it gives you a broad view of the law and what it applies to.
Yeah. So I graduated 2014 from the University of Kansas, made my way to rural Nevada after graduation due to a lot of family connections, I guess. Actually, my former boss, Mr. Hoagie's here. He was the Lincoln County District Attorney who hired me, now the state, for counsel for the State Bar of Nevada. And he taught me a lot. But Mr. Frainer is right. If you want a lot of experience and want to experience a lot of different types of things, rural Nevada, rural anywhere probably is really a great place to go. Within the about 14 months of me being at the Lincoln County District Attorney's Office, I assisted on my first murder trial. And so that was a huge experience for me, especially as a young attorney. And I got a lot of experience for that. I've been doing public defense work now for the past 5.5 years. And again, you get everything from misdemeanor traffic cases to Category A felonies that we are defending or prosecuting in rural Nevada. And the number of cases might not be the same, but the quality of cases are there as well. So it's been a great 9 years for me, and I can't envision myself going anywhere else.
There was no law school here at the time. I went to Arizona State University, and I believe some of the faculty from there are the ones that came here to start this law school. I started working for my father-in-law in a civil practice firm, general civil law, and I hated every minute of it. I thought I made a big mistake. I've gone to law school. I don't even like law. My brother was in the DA's office doing criminal law, and he says, why don't you try criminal law? It's funner, and it was. And I put in my time there. I was a litigator, did the trial work for about, 15 years, and then I was chief of the appellate unit in the position that Alex now holds. And I retired in 2019, and I do this now. I take contract cases. I actually went to a friend, and I tried to get into a little bit of personal injury and, again, hated civil law. So I'm doing what I said I would never do, and I'm representing criminal defendants, not in trial, but exclusively habeas and appeals. And it's a lot of fun, and I keep my license active.
How's it feel to be on the other side now in criminal cases?
You know, the law's the same. It's just you know, you got to get used to losing more, but it's not balanced. As prosecutors, the deck is stacked in their favor, but you have to be very creative as a defense attorney, and it's the same law. So it's not that big of a change mentally to do that.
Do any of you have any recommendations for students to best find their future career path? A lot of people know what they want to do, but a lot more don't know what they want to do when they're in law school till maybe later.
I would suggest just try different things. When I went to law school, I had no idea what I wanted to practice. I ended up joining the mock trial team, found that I really enjoyed getting up in front of people and being able to present. And I still didn't think I wanted to do criminal law. I was looking at water law and all these different things, but as I ended up out in rural Nevada, actually criminal law is the stuff that I enjoy the most. I love the facts. I love the stories. I love helping victims. When I was a defense attorney, I loved helping defendants. It was just that one-on-one connection with individuals that really made a difference for me. But again, it was just trying different things that I didn't think I knew what I wanted to do. And the more you try, the more you get to understand what you want.
I didn't know this school does a great job of internships. We have Professor Christensen here, Nell. She coordinates all of our interns, and I believe Elizabeth Dallin and one of the court's own, Alyssa as well, all interned in our office and are now working within the office. So even if being a DA or a public defender or whatever your preferences are, try it out. Try a semester because you might learn something that you had no idea that you might love. And I highly just recommend taking advantage of the internship programs that I know are offered here.
I bet Judge Bolo, would you like to give a little introduction? I heard that the school Arizona State mentioned a few minutes ago.
Yeah. It's really, again, so nice to be here. I actually came to Las Vegas to practice law in 1987. Which I am quite confident is a year before many of you were born. I've been here since then. My practice was civil, and for the 12 years before I took the appellate court bench, I was the discovery commissioner for Clark County in the 8th Judicial District Court, and I know that many of you will find this shocking, but the lawyers don't get along very well during the discovery process when they're trying to decide who they get to talk to and what documents they get to receive. So it is somewhat of a contentious time, but I was appointed by Governor Sisolak in 2019 to the Nevada Court of Appeals, and I have been here since, and I enjoy my colleagues, I enjoy working with them. Yes, I did go to ASU. Fortunately, one Washington, one UCLA, Idaho, I think. So anyway, this year at least we didn't have any discussions on sports, but I really enjoy what I do. I enjoyed the oral argument from all of counsel. I appreciated the work that went into it, and we can tell. We can tell how you answer questions and how you respond to our concerns. It is a wonderful profession. No matter what you decide to do in your life, having a law degree will be a wonderful opportunity for you to do many things. So I'm excited to be here today and to see the excitement that you all have. Your future is bright.
Chief?
Go ahead.
Oh, me? All right. So my name is Deborah Westbrook. I grew up in the Pacific Northwest, so this weather that we're experiencing right now is what I'm used to. I always knew from a young age I wanted to be a writer. I didn't think lawyer, didn't think judge. I wanted to be a writer. I wrote for my high school paper. I wrote for my college paper. Went to University of Washington undergraduate. I went to University of Washington Law School. Kind of thought I would stay in the Pacific Northwest, but life had other plans for me. Got married my third year of law school and ended up moving to Washington, D.C. with my husband. And I gave up a job at a corporate securities law firm because I didn't actually want to be in the courtroom. I didn't want to litigate. I just kind of wanted to be behind the scenes and
Well, that I wasn't able to stick with that job since, you know, they didn't have an office opening for me in D.C., but I clerked on the D.C. Court of Appeals, and that's where I realized, wow, appellate work is amazing. I would love to do this. I got to figure out a way to make this my career. We ended up moving to Las Vegas in 2004. I worked at a small boutique labor and employment firm, Kamer, Zucker & Abbott. Then moved on to Littler Mendelson, where I stayed for about 8 years. And by the end of that, my husband was actually at the PD's office. He was on their appellate team. And I saw the work that he was doing, and I was thinking, wow, you have my dream job. If there's any way I could do what you do, this would be just fabulous. Well, he ended up leaving that position so that I could get a job at the PD's office. I applied and said, hey, I will come over if you hire me just for appeals. I took a 50% pay cut, and it was the best decision of my life. I spent 10 years at the PD's office getting to litigate against amazing attorneys like Alex Chen and Steve Owens. And I mean, it was basically my dream job. And I could have stayed there forever, but you know, I had people suggesting, you know, maybe you might want to be a judge. So kind of took that path, and I've been there for a year now at the Court of Appeals, and I love working with my colleagues. This is the best job. We have amazing staff. It's fabulous. So just know, you know, your life may take many different turns. Where you start out at a firm is, you know, probably, I mean, it might be where you end up, but you have so many options in the legal profession. I mean, you don't even have to practice law with a law degree. It really opens up a lot of doors for you. So just be excited about your future. There's a lot you got to look forward to.
Well, it's a joy to be here today also. I was last here at the end of August. I had the honor of swearing in the student attorneys. And that was a great experience. There were a lot of people here. The students were going into various externships, other jobs, and I was just thrilled to be part of that, because that's the best way, I think, to find out what practicing law is all about. You're in a real law firm or a public office, and like you know, Ms. Blake's here today, helping with the Lincoln County District Attorney. I mean, how great is that? You know, go to school here and then actually working in a DA's office, you know, outside of the area. So that's a wonderful opportunity. I don't even remember having externships when I was in law school, but I worked at a small law firm in Pullman, Washington. I was at University of Idaho, and it's right on the border with Washington. And so there weren't many externships. There weren't many judges in those two towns. So I never even thought about working for a judge before. So after law school, I knew I wanted to be a trial lawyer, and I was trying to get a job in the district attorney's office, the public defender's office. Didn't get either one of them, but I got the law clerk position. Started off with a great judge, Howard McKibben. And in the time I spent with him, I realized that being a judge is the person that's largely directs what happens within the court system, how critical the role was. And I started thinking about it, oh, that would be kind of an interesting job to have, but trial experience is necessary. So I wanted to get it, joined the district attorney's office in Douglas County in Northern Nevada, and spent more than 13 years there. And we had what we called vertical prosecution. You know, unlike Clark County, where it's a very large office and you have different divisions, we have a small office. So if I got a case, I handled it from start to finish. That meant working on investigation, doing all the justice court proceedings, all the district court proceedings, and if it was appealed, the Supreme Court proceedings too. So that got me interested in appellate law also, having done that work. After my time there, I was elected to the district court. And I was in a general jurisdiction district court in a small area, Minden, but we had everything. So it was great. I mean, just exposure across the board to all types of law. My main area was criminal law, and I didn't do that much criminal law in the district court. I did a lot more civil and family law. But knowing the rules of evidence so well from being in court all the time just helped tremendously no matter where you are. So you got to get in the courtroom. Everybody has to at least try to get in the courtroom and get the experience and see where it takes you from there. And that after while at the district court, I thought that since I'm in a small area, I want to learn what's going on in the rest of the state. So I volunteered to sit as a visiting judge, and I ended up in 9 different counties of the 17 counties in Nevada, including for 9 consecutive years in Clark County. So that was a great, great, great experience. And talk about being in rural Nevada. I spent 7 weeks in a jury trial in Tonopah. I did my penance right there. That's what I would call rural Nevada.
And you had to do your own discovery, too. Yeah. You didn't have a discovery commissioner.
No, no discovery commissioner. But when the Court of Appeals was on the ballot in 2014, I thought, I was thinking about retiring, and I thought, you know, that looks really interesting. At the time, my brother was on the Supreme Court, and he was pushing me to take a look at this. And so I did. I decided to go for it, and I was fortunate to be appointed to the court. And so I've been there since the inception in 2015. And luckily, we have the best edition of the court yet right now. So I'm really happy the way things are going. And the hard work and the well-reasoned approach to all of our cases that are brought by my colleagues. So we have a good cross-section here, and it really helps. So back to my original statement about being here in August of 2023, externships, working at law offices, volunteering, clinics, all of those extra things that students can do will really help you career-wise. You'll understand things better. You'll start making contacts. And then academically, of course, doing extra things like the law journal and the moot court where you can do that. That's tremendous help. And, of course, leads to jobs like with our court. So that's what I would recommend to everybody. Get involved no matter what you're doing. Don't be somebody who just reads the books, but do more than that. I mean, the study is super important, but you have to do a lot more than that. Do we have any other questions? Anything from our esteemed staff over here? No. Ms. Blake, anything from you? Hey, it's your chance still to talk if you want to.
I think we should probably get some pictures while we still got some folks here.
All right. We are done then with our arguments today and our